Well, on today's Catholic News podcast, we're speaking to our lead bishop for Africa, Bishop Paul Swarbrick, who's also the Bishop of Lancaster. Bishop Paul, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, James.
Now, look, we've got so many continental realities, haven't we, playing out at the moment. But our focus today is Ethiopia, and in particularly Tigray, because you travelled to the country some 6 months ago now, from the 17th to the 28th of March. That was at the invitation of CAFOD, the Church's Aid and Development Agency here in England and Wales, but also SCIAF, the equivalent in Scotland, and TROCARE, the equivalent in Ireland. So, where to start? Well, I know you have a love for Africa and her countries, and of course you served as a missionary priest in Zambia for several years. First question, what was on your mind when you accepted the invitation to go to Ethiopia? I mean, particularly in light of the horrors of the Tigray War, which is considered to be one of the deadliest conflicts of the 21st century.
Privilege, I think, is very high on the list of things that came to mind. To visit these countries as a stranger going in for the first time, and yet to be so generously welcomed and accompanied into people's lives and situations, it's an intense privilege and an extremely humbling experience as well.
Did you sort of have the dangers sort of creeping into your mind, or was that not a factor for you?
I think as a bishop, you take on a sort of a spirit of martyrdom just by the very appointment, in a sense. And I don't want to be too negative about that, but you are so close to Christ. You're drawn so intimately into his life, in my experience, that there's a sense that you've, in some ways, already given yourself, and whatever happens, you know, will be part of what's supposed to happen if you're a true disciple of Christ. So I was open-minded, and I must say that it was a very positive experience throughout. Nothing distracted me from the good stuff.
Excellent. Now, look, we'll go on to the elements, the dimensions of your visit. But I just wanted to talk about cuts to the aid budget, because that's something that the UK government announced earlier this year, the ODA, Official Development Assistance. In terms of what you saw, how do you assess the impact of this? You know, you saw internally displaced people, for instance, in Ethiopia. You saw the NGOs like CAFOD, SCIAF, TROCARE trying to help them. What's your assessment of those cuts? How will it impact?
I must mention I'm no expert on these things. So what I was able to pick up is often in the domain of sort of general comment, really. I did go out there just after US aid had been withdrawn from many of these situations as well. So there was a very significant impact on a lot of aid work and development work going on. The Catholic churches and faith-based organizations generally are very much involved in delivering education and health care. And they source funding from elsewhere, but they also benefit from USAID, from European Union, from UK. And therefore, any reduction in those sources of aid are bound to have a direct impact on a number of people. I'm thinking, first of all, of immunization programs, which are affected. Children are not being immunized because of these cuts. Antiretrovirals are not being given. And people have lost employment. What happens in that situation is that you have needy people looking elsewhere, going to the remaining agencies that are still funded to a lesser degree. And therefore, those other agencies, the demands on their personnel, on their time, on resources, increases incredibly. And of course, the gap can't be closed between what is on offer and what is needed. And so there's a growing awareness of inadequacy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, Bishop Paul, in my intro, I talked about the horrors of the Tigray War, considered one of the deadliest conflicts of the 21st century. Now, in your travel diary, you wrote about the trauma of war in Ethiopia, and particularly the impact on the people, obviously. there was one really interesting illustration that touched me, and that was when you met with the interfaith leaders, and they told you that some people are even afraid of birds in flight. Tell us why that is.
You will have heard of the use of drones in modern warfare, particularly relating to Gaza and Ukraine and now Poland as well. But what I was made aware of is how people instinctively now, if they see black dots in the sky, even in the distance, they associate them first with hostile drones rather than with birds, wildlife, that sort of thing. And so that's the mentality that they have after their experience of warfare.
Yeah. And what do you think the lasting impact is of war and that trauma? Did anyone speak to you specifically about that, or was it your own sort of observations?
I heard stories. There's intense sadness, there's frustration, there are some open wounds in the community. I heard one person telling me of something he had heard being spoken by people in positions of responsibility and authority, not in Tigray, but these people had said, better to live with demons than to live with Tigrayans. There is not open warfare in Tigray now, but I think 20% of the area is occupied still by Eritreans, people I met in displaced persons camps. It was very touching that when I visited them, they just had some significant rain. There was a rain shower that happened just as I arrived, actually. And the people were enjoying that in one sense. But then I found some people, old people, obviously farmers, who had had to leave their areas, their fields, their homes. And I was just thinking, this rain will make them think of their homes and their fields that are now occupied by others. Terrific sadness.
Actually, it made me think, when it comes to the older generations, I'm not saying they've seen it all before, but they will certainly have had some experience of violence, suffering, famine, possibly to a certain extent. Is it the younger generations that have gone through this conflict and war that really don't have that anchor? Do you find they still have that sense of hope, or do you think that they're significantly damaged by this?
From my limited time there, I think there is lasting damage in the memories and in the being displaced and in the violence and the whole injustice of it all. There are growing numbers of displaced persons, and there doesn't seem to be anywhere for them. The support they're given in these camps is constantly being reduced, and that in turn leads to them going off looking wherever they can for whatever is available. And of course, women are very often victims of sexual violence, but you can see how efforts to stabilize populations are losing ground, really. And the destabilized population, all sorts of other problems come with it. People become prey to all sorts of evils and badness, and it just perpetuates and actually grows a problem rather than solves it. I think stability of population and food and healthcare are key to that. Stability of population is a key way forward, and it's just not happening.
Feels quite helpless, doesn't it? But in terms of that faith element, was there any way for the internally displaced people to worship or to celebrate their faith in any way?
Yes. The faith communities are playing an absolutely key role. And I think that From my time in South Sudan as well, a couple of years ago, I learnt this. It became more clear. The faith communities, without being sort of snobbish or elitist, they can actually offer a stability of leadership and a consistency of leadership that isn't found within most political leaders and systems and parties. You know, politics is always changing with votes and force of arms, whereas the faith communities, they're just present. And as I say, there's a stability there, which I think offers a degree of hope that sometimes the politics doesn't carry.
Well, you said it a bit earlier, didn't you, that as a bishop, as a Catholic leader, there has to be that abandonment to self, that dedication to Christ. So we will come on to your meeting with various bishops and others. But I know there was a great impact upon you, wasn't there, by that meeting that you had with the Daughters of Charity. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it might set me off again. I'd met with displaced persons. This was in Mekele in Tigray, and it was the first day of my visit there. And I listened after I'd visited the displaced persons and seen the sadness in the eyes of the old people, just the lostness of people there. I was invited to listen to a report on the work of the Daughters of Charity. And it's affecting me now, actually. What hit home so much was the awfulness of what was done to one of these women in particular. I didn't meet her, I was just told about her, but the way she had suffered violence, rape.
Beggars belief.
It's just the level of badness and the level of evil that is so planned and so calculated you can imagine it would be better to be killed than to live with what's been done to you, or what's been done to your mother or your daughter or sister or your neighbour. You know, there's a horror to it which it almost paralyzes you in terms of wanting to make a response.
But then did you find that those religious sisters were able to, in spite of that horror, actually, you know, be present and kind and caring to those women in particular?
Definitely. And not just the sisters either, but through the sisters and through the work of CAFOD, SCIAF, THROCRA, there's a compassion there. There's a practical reaching out and being alongside these victims. I went on, they took me also to some safe spaces for girls and women. And you're seeing women there who are, they put on such a positive and respectful and joyful face, but you can just sense what they are carrying, not just mentally, but physically, the trauma of it, how they manage to sleep or live with it, I do not know. Carrying babies in the womb that are the product of a rape. You know, that sort of, and I'm not suggesting in any way that they shouldn't do that, but the reality of knowing who the father, or that the father is one who, a stranger who raped them, for example, and yet so respectful of that life and just knowing it's not the baby's fault, I suppose, and then hopefully they will be able to love that child and that child will be part of maybe the healing.
Goodness me. I expect those women have been part of your prayers ever since.
Yeah.
Well, that, I mean, what incredible work, because it must be very, very hard to sort of, you know, compassionately care whilst trying not to be broken by those horrors. It's an incredibly difficult thing, caring in those circumstances, isn't it?
It is. But this is where faith, I think, and the gospel comes in. And Christ, who said, you know, my peace I give you, a peace not of this world is my gift to you. That doesn't mean that all other efforts are a waste of time. But what it means is that the human spirit is crying out for something that this world alone cannot provide. And a hope that this, you know, our feeble efforts, heroic feeble efforts sometimes just cannot achieve, but there's something that awakens in us when we encounter the Lord that is able to overcome being overwhelmed by the bad stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember actually when we spoke about your visit to South Sudan, you talked then about the hope in people, that faith in Christ, the joy even to a certain extent. And that seems like a silly word to use under the circumstances. But did you see happiness, dare I say, joy?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's you become almost bipolar to some extent, I suppose, because you're moving from these intensely tragic stories, and then you move to somewhere not soon afterwards, or quite soon afterwards, where there's dancing and joy, and you just, how can this exist so close together? So as I say, there's something slightly bipolar about it, but at the same, just more generally, as priests in this country, you know, I'm from here. I spent my first years as a priest in parishes locally here in the Northwest. You do get a little bit used to that sort of jumping about. You may be dealing with a tragic funeral of a child, for example, and then the next thing you're talking to couples getting married. So you're used to that, but it's just the extreme, I suppose, that takes some adjusting to. Yeah, you have to accept both sides and realize that it's part of the same story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Goodness, Phil, I need to take a breath after that. Let's talk about some of the religious leaders you met. You've talked about the religious communities as well. Now you're going to have to help me with my pronunciation and my my attributing the correct bishops to the correct places. But I did see that you had an interesting meeting with Bishop Tesfa Selassie from Adigrat in the region of Tigray. Is that correct?
Yes. He's been bishop there for about 23 years, and he's a wonderful man and a wonderful shepherd of his people. He's stayed with them throughout the difficult times, and he's a great advocate for them. He's respected beyond his own denomination, the Catholic Church. He's certainly an authority figure, but a wonderful, gentle, determined shepherd.
Well, you know what? I hope this doesn't sound trite, but I couldn't help, when I was sent a few pictures of your visit, to notice an aspect of hospitality that surprised me somewhat, because it looked like you were having a cup of tea with some popcorn. Is that true?
All right, yes.
Tea and popcorn. So, talking about all this
coffee, probably coffee and popcorn, I would suggest, because coffee is the big thing there.
Yeah. Are you a coffee drinker?
I was there.
Well, he does sound like a wonderful man, but he must have seen it all, hasn't he? How did he express that to you?
He simply told me of some of his experiences during the difficult years, early, well, 2022, that sort of time. He can't even visit parts of his own diocese because they're occupied by Eritreans. He doesn't rant, not in my presence anyway. I didn't see him behave like that. He's a modest man. He's utterly given to being shepherd of his flock. I don't think anything would be able to pull him away from where he is now.
It must be very hard for him, talking specifically about those people that he's separated from, to be the Catholic shepherd of those people, yet to be... Does he have great sort of... anxiety about those he can't reach, or is that one where you have no choice? You just simply have to hand it to God and pray for them.
From my time with him, he was such a kind, gentle pastor that it would have been easy to overlook the cost of the difficulties he's experiencing. I am pretty confident that, given his kindness and his warmth, he is suffering intensely. In that he can't reach the parishioners, the faithful, in certain parts of his diocese.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to ignore another visit you made. Was it to Bishop de Guéné? Have I said that correctly?
I'm not an expert on this. I think it's Bishop de Guéné, and he's a Franciscan, and he's a fairly new bishop in the diocese of Sodo, in the southern part of Ethiopia. Young fellow, a local, again, very hospitable, in very humble surroundings, and yet he's trying to build up the structures within the diocese that will serve to promote the gospel.
Well, that sounds positive. Now, look, we're fast running out of time, but I did want to ask you this, because I know sometimes there's that frustration as to how Ethiopia is seen somewhat stereotypically, because certainly I look back to when I was a young man. I mean, for decades, it's been framed, if you like, as a place of suffering, war, violence and famine, of course, remember from the mid 80s. But I know you have, and you've explained it to me just now, witnessed the great resilience and the hope in the face of all the suffering. But it's not just suffering, is it? Tell us a bit about, you know, the strength of faith. It's a Jubilee year, isn't it? Pilgrims of Hope is our motto. So where do you see hope in Ethiopia?
First of all, in the people, I think that has to be the number one. They are a very noble people, and they have deep Christian roots, as we know from the scriptures, from the New Testament, not least from the Old. And they carry a hope through just, I think the cultures of Africa very often, they have an instinct for joy, which sometimes we in the West might struggle to find. Hospitality is a great thing in their culture. And there are people who are prepared to stay with them as committed organizers of benefit. That sounds a bit obscure, but I'm thinking of people like Tamrat, who is leading the Kafod, Skiaf and Trokra team in Ethiopia, Addis Ababa. She is working there to help people get together to sort of reflect and talk about the situations they're in, the circumstances they're in, so that even if they can't do much about it immediately, there's a growing awareness of the extent of what's needed, and a pooling of resources and thoughtfulness, minds, that sort of thing, rather than just a sort of a reaction to things and a sort of more fatalistic approach. So that there are genuine people staying there who have that quality of leadership which enables people to reflect and prioritize and then organize. When you've got a problem, if you know that someone's there to listen to you and walk a bit with you and maybe suggest things to you or help you think things through, then that's terrifically valuable.
No, absolutely. And it's a bit of an and finally, but what would your message be to Catholics in England of Wales that have listened to this, you know, heartbreaking in parts, inspiring in parts, I hope as well. What would you say to them if they want to focus their prayers on Ethiopia, Tigray?
I would say to them, first of all, that whilst there are horrors in these places, there is treasure of great value as well in the faith of the people who are working there, living there. Can I just go on a little story of what helps me in these situations?
Of course.
I think of Christ telling us that we can't serve two masters, and that he was talking about, obviously, God the Father and sort of Caesar. But I think as well, if we think of Christ, there were many miracles he did not do, many people he did not feed, even though he fed the 5,000 and so on. There were many people he didn't heal. One thing we do see him engaged in is constantly withdrawing from the crowds to find time to pray and to listen to the Father and to ensure that he could have been giving 24/7 to the people and their needs, but he constantly appeared to, in fact, almost withdraw from them in order to spend time with his true master, the Father. And that's what the church is doing. Yes, it's busy with aid and humanitarian efforts, but the church brings something else as well. Not to devalue the humanitarian aspects of it all, but the church brings that opportunity to step back into the presence of God the Father, into the presence of the true Master, and to spend time there listening, learning, being loved, so that when Christ did return to the people and their needs, their immediate needs, he served them in a way which was relevant to what he was about. And it's the same that's going on there now. The work of Kafod, Skiaf, Trokra, these faith-based groups, it's helping them materially and in a humanitarian way, but it's also opening up the light of that gospel, the peace this world cannot give, the hope that is beyond our ability to achieve. And I think that I would encourage people to just plug into that and let that come into focus and let it inspire them and uplift them, because it's certainly alive in the people I saw there, in spite of all their sufferings, in spite of all that's going wrong, in spite of all that's robbing them of their life and what we take so much for granted. They're not giving up. The other thing that I would like to mention is that the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office wrote to me in August to explain that they are firmly committed to localization and working with faith-based groups. And on my last day in Ethiopia, I visited the British High Commission there, British Embassy, and spoke with the deputy head of the embassy. And I tried to put across to him the value of, given that these missions now are getting less money through the government, they need to make more use of the relationships they can establish within these countries to benefit the work of us all. And I think they are doing that. They're listening to faith-based groups. They're listening to the churches. They're getting information from them as to what's going on and what needs to happen. So I'd just like to put in a word of gratitude for those in government offices who we often like to beat up a bit, but there's some good people there as well. And CAFOD, as I say, one of the gifts of CAFOD is helping people come together from all sorts of circumstances and reflect on things and plan a way forward.
Very well said. Yeah, you're right. We do sometimes give our officials a bit of a hard time.
Yeah.
Well, look, that's really appreciated, giving us that time. I should drop a little link in for those that want to find out more. If you go to cafod.org.uk, certainly talking from our International Aid and Development Agency's perspective, you can find out more about its work in Ethiopia. Just search for Ethiopia and you'll get all sorts of interesting background, the impact in 2024 and exactly why CAFOD works in Ethiopia. But Bishop Paul, thank you for your time. Appreciated.
You're very welcome, James, and God's blessing on your work as well.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I'm sure we'll be speaking again about the myriad of complex realities in African countries. But for now, thank you very much indeed.
Take care. God bless.